Committees, are you ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Do you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
If I may reserve 3 minutes, please.
Okay, you can start whenever you're ready.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, Paul Galanides appearing for Carlos Chambers, and I'd like to begin by thanking the court and the clerk's office and opposing counsel, Mr. Chandeville, for accommodating my trial schedule and the telephone argument. Your Honors, this is a case about an absentee homeowner who discovers that in the month since he last visited his property, items were stolen from his shed and the shed's doors were damaged. Now, the reason this court ought to reverse the B&E conviction and the reason why the Commonwealth brief misses the mark is not because the issue in this B&E case was who done it. The issue is whether or not a breaking and entering ever occurred at all. I think that the parties were in agreement on the standard of the law. The standard is was there evidence from which the jury or the fact finder could conclude that entry was effected with an E, affected basically whether or not some sort of damage to the doors or entry to the, whether the damage to the doors or the windows to the property yielded entry, whether entry resulted.
Mr. Galanides,
yes.
This is just petty.
Yes, sir.
I was looking closely at the Finney case that you cite because it is somewhat on point. And I'd like you to address this because this thought occurred to me. The jury's entitled to believe all or a portion of the defendant's testimony and is entitled to reject all or any portion of that testimony. Here, Chambers testified that the door was closed when he went in to pick up the property. Doesn't that constitute an admission of a break-in?
Judge, respectfully, his testimony was that he was admitted to the property by a woman who used a key to open the door and to allow him to take those items out.
But if the jury rejects anything about the woman letting him in, but accepts his testimony that the door was shut prior to the entry, isn't that sufficient to support the jury's verdict?
Your Honor, I would respectfully argue that is a hair that the court or the fact finder could not split. The defendant's testimony was that the entry that he described and the closed door that he described were all in conjunction with being admitted lawfully or by virtue of a key without any sort of breaking. So I would argue that the jury could not single out that element of it and then conclude that there had been a breaking. But it even still begs the question, how did this entry occur? Even if the jury were willing to believe that the building was closed and that somehow items were actually stolen from it, to prove a breaking and entry, there still must be some evidence that there was entry through one of these.
Would you agree that the evidence is sufficient to show that he removed the property from the building?
Well, he admitted as much. Yes, sir,
okay.
He did.
And when he testified, which he did not have to do, of course, but when he testified, he said nothing about the doors being open when he went in. So isn't that sufficient to allow the jury to conclude that in conjunction with an obvious evidence of an attempt to at least break in, isn't that sufficient to allow them to conclude that however he got in, the doors were shut before he got there?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that it could. I don't think that the jury could single out that item, separate it from the rest of his story, and then conclude that he damaged the property and then somehow got in. I cited the case of Massey versus Firmstone, and with a nod to Judge Elder. I know that he cited that case on occasion, and I do think that that's the appropriate standard here, where the Commonwealth's evidence is basically an equipoise. The Commonwealth's own witnesses, the one deputy assured the jury that entry had been made through one door, and then the Commonwealth's own witness, Mr. Hughes, the owner of the property, got up and testified that it was not only that it didn't happen through that door, but that it was impossible. So I still think that the jury would have to have some sort of basis upon which to conclude there had actually been a breaking and an entry into the building, other than Mr. Chambers' testimony that he was admitted by virtue of a authorized seller with a key.
But in order to accept that argument, your argument, you have to accept his defense that he was let in by this mystery woman, and the jury rejected that, and frankly, I think there's quite a bit of evidence to support that finding, the surreptitious entry, the poll camera pictures, the evidence of damage to the doors, the deputy did not see the phone number on the quote on the so-called receipt. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that the defendant lied. And if you reject the defense that he was let in by this woman, what other explanation can there possibly be as to how he got entry into the building?
Your Honor, I think that that raises the question of the sufficiency of the evidence and whether or not the jury could have properly rejected the hypothesis of innocence that he was sold the items by someone who claimed to have authority to do so. Now, I think that there's two things that I would specifically cite to respond to your question. And number one, because this is an absentee owner of the property, the Commonwealth does not have the benefit of evidence that indicates that the damage to the doors occurred at the same time as the larceny of the property. The Commonwealth also doesn't have the benefit that flows when the defendant...
Well, let me stop you there. Doesn't though, the evidence of the damage to the window and the footprint and broken frame on the other door, isn't that evidence that those doors were shut and locked at that point? I mean, why would somebody try to break a window or kick in the door if the door is wide open?
Well, I think the facts of the case support a reasonable hypothesis that the defendant was sold the property, that the doors were reclosed, and then at some point prior to the owner's discovery that there was vandalism that occurred, perhaps by someone who went back or by someone who went to the property for the first time and attempted to get in and take more. But this is not a situation where a homeowner's been gone for an hour or an evening and then comes back and discovers larceny and damage to the property at the same time.
Is it your position that your two assignments of error it's an all or nothing proposition? We either have to, if we can't affirm on the sufficiency and reverse on the challenge to the burglary only.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I believe the decision to reverse is compelled by the facts in both cases. But I would admit that there are two separate questions that can be considered. And but here's why I believe the Commonwealth was obligated.
My question is, if we conclude that the evidence was sufficient to support the grand larceny conviction, aren't
yes,
we
sir.
Then compelled to affirm on the breaking?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I simply maintain there's just not that evidence that allows the inference that the larceny and the and I don't believe there's evidence from which the fact finder can conclude a B&E actually took place. And that's why I don't believe they can reject a hypothesis that the defendant was responsible, because the Commonwealth has to prove the crime before they assign responsibility. And here's why I believe the Commonwealth also had an obligation to bring in that real estate agent and refute the hypothesis of innocence that Mr. Chambers purchased this property from someone with a key, and that is because the very first day of the investigation, Mr. Chambers told the police he bought the property from someone who claimed authority and who opened the doors and provided it to him. And he had receipts within hours of being inquired of this. He actually had spoken to the purchaser of the property, Mr. Blanks, and Mr. Blanks had reviewed an offer sheet. I don't want to call it a story, because that's not what you're supposed to call the defendant's explanation of his innocence, but this explanation of innocence existed long before the investigation began, and it was proven when he came to court and supported it with his further testimony. The Commonwealth looked for a Laura Jones, but they didn't look for anyone else who had a key to the property, and that's what they should have been bringing in to refute. I think that the defendant established that this explanation existed beforehand, and as the court will recall, the standard for adjudicating someone responsible when he is in recent possession of stolen property is if the explanation is false, if he falsely denies possessing the property, or if the explanation, or if he has no explanation at all. And I don't think they disproved either one in this case.
Mr. Galanides, you don't disagree with the fact that the determination of whether a reasonable hypothesis of innocence exists is a factual finding for the trier of fact, do you?
If there has been a crime proven, then I understand, yes, ma'am, that Your Honor, that is a determination for the trier of fact. But in this case, I would argue there's not evidence to prove that a B&E actually occurred. There was no evidence that actually proved entry other than what the defendant explained was lawful entry by virtue of a key. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. If I may, reserve the last 2 minutes to respond.
Actually, you have a little more time, but we'll let you reserve it.
Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, Mr. Shandoval, you have 15 minutes whenever you'd like to get started.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chris Shandoval for the Commonwealth. This case really presents a choice between two competing theories. You have the defendant's theory, which is that a woman he met at the store told him that she had some property to sell and let him into a shed using a key, and then he therefore, as a result, removed the items from the shed and took them and sold them to someone that he knew. Or you have the Commonwealth's theory, which is that the defendant and a co-defendant, a Mr. Dante Glover, broke into that shed, stole the items from inside the shed.
Mr. Shandoval, do you agree that there's absolutely no evidence that those doors were broken in, that they actually gained physical entry through either one of those doors?
No, Your Honor, I do not agree with that statement. And the reason I don't is because on page 30 of the appendix, when Deputy Morgan was asked about what he observed when he got to the shed, he testified that the back door of the shed, the window was broke. They didn't get in that way. They come around to the other side, and the door was kicked in.
I lived in the country for a while, and that's kind of a euphemism. It doesn't necessarily mean you were successful.
Well, I think that the jury is entitled to draw whatever.
But the owner testified that couldn't happen because he had a 2x4 nailed to prevent the doors from opening. And he also testified. He also testified that they were out swing doors.
Well, I think so. He did testify to that. Of course, the owner was not present when the breaking or entering occurred. So the owner is testifying based on his.
But he was the owner was the first one to arrive on the scene. He discovered the larceny.
Correct, Your Honor.
Don't you think he would have noticed if someone had managed to get in that double door?
I think if the doors have been shut and the doors are all shut back up, he may not know exactly how they got in, and so he can testify about what he thinks happened. But the officer, from his testimony and claiming that the door looked to be kicked in, he also testified without objection that the shed had been broken into. He said that twice. At one time, there was an objection that was sustained. The other time he gave that testimony, there was no objection. And so that testimony went to the jury without any objection. So based on the deputy's testimony that had been broken into and that the door had been kicked in, and when he says, you know, the window was broken, but they didn't get in that way, the door was kicked in, I think that implies that his understanding was they broke in, they got in through the door. And
if that is susceptible to different interpretations, do we have to assume that the jury concluded that the door is opened?
You do, Your Honor. You have to assume, this is from Wright versus West, U.S. Supreme Court, a reviewing court faced with a record of historical facts that supports conflicting inferences must presume, even if it does not affirmatively appear in the record, that the trier of fact resolved any such conflicts in favor of the prosecution and must defer to that resolution. So the jury clearly concluded that Mr. Chambers broke into this shed and got in. There's testimony from the deputy that Mr. Chambers broke in through these doors. There's competing, conflicting testimony from the owner that he didn't think Chambers could have broken in through these doors. And so this court, faced with that record of conflicting inferences, has to presume the jury resolved it in favor of the Commonwealth.
But how do you kick in doors that are outswing doors?
It's possible that the door might have been kicked in such a way that it broke the latch, and then the door was swung outwards to then effectuate the entry. So maybe the kicking in of the door caused the door to break, and then they swung it open outwards to get inside. I think there are maybe you kick it in most of the way, enough to squeeze in, but maybe you don't get in all the way. I think there are inferences the jury could draw that it's possible to get into that shed. And I think that conclusion was bolstered in this case by the fact that Mr. Chambers testified at trial, and he made many statements before trial and gave his version of events. And
let me ask you this, counsel. This is Judge Alston. Without Chambers' statement, would you be able to make this case on appeal?
Without Chambers' statement, both to the investigators before trial and in his testimony at trial, this case would be much closer to Finney. And so we would have a much more difficult time distinguishing Finney. I would still argue that this case would be different than Finney, because in Finney, one of the facts that the court relied on in saying that the evidence was not sufficient to show the defendant was involved in the breaking and entering was the fact that it was clear that at least two people had been involved in stealing the tools from inside the shed in that case. And in Finney, the defendant was seen by himself at the scene. So it was clear that at some other time, two people had been there and had effectuated a breaking and entering, and so it was unclear whether he'd been involved. In this case, obviously, Mr. Chambers and his co-defendant, or accomplice, Mr. Glover, were both present together, and so it's fair to conclude here, unlike in Finney, that Mr. Chambers was involved in the breaking and entering. But I do think that without the defendant's statements, this would be a very difficult case for us to prevail on appeal. If he had never said anything, if Mr. Chambers had never given any explanation as to how he'd gotten into the shed, he could then come on appeal and say, well, the Commonwealth failed to prove that the doors were shut, for example. So the Commonwealth failed to disprove the theory that maybe I walked in during the day, didn't effectuate a breaking, and therefore there was no breaking and entering, or maybe I never walked in at all. However, by making the statements that he made before trial to the investigators, and especially by testifying at trial, he's really locked himself into that theory of the case, that when he got to the shed, the doors were shut and locked, and a key needed to be used in order to get into the shed, or in the alternative under the Commonwealth theory, the defendant and his accomplice broke into that shed because they didn't have a key, because this woman never let them inside. And I think there's irony in Mr. Chambers' and opposing counsel's citation to the Massey case, because the Massey case actually is fatal to Chambers' argument. What the court said in Massey, and this is at, and Massey, of course, is 134 VA 450, this is at 462, the court says, as a general rule, when two or more witnesses introduced by a party litigant vary in their statements of fact, such party has the right to ask the court or the jury to accept as true the statements most favorable to him. So in this case, the fact that the deputy seemed to believe that entry had been made through those doors, the Commonwealth is entitled to ask the jury to believe that testimony, despite conflicting testimony from the owner. However, what the court went on to say is, this is not true as to the testimony which he gives himself, or the litigant. No litigant can successfully ask a court or a jury to believe that he has not told the truth. His statements of fact and inferences therefrom are binding upon him. He cannot be heard to ask that his case be made stronger than he makes it, whereas here depends upon facts within his knowledge and as to which he has testified. So when the defendant
if I hear you, what you're saying is that even though the Commonwealth, their entire theory of the case was that these two people kicked in that side door and gained entry that way, that the jury could reject the Commonwealth's own theory of the case and adopt snippets of the defendant's statement in order to supply the missing element?
No, Your Honor, that's not our position. Our position is that Mr. Chambers' testimony, explanation for what occurred, up to a certain point, is consistent with the Commonwealth's theory of the case. So his testimony, that when he got to that shed, a key had to be used to get inside, from which you can infer the doors were shut and locked. That is consistent with the Commonwealth theory, is that when he got to the shed, the doors were shut and locked. The difference is, how was that entry made? Was it made with a key, or was it made by breaking and entering? And those are really the only two options if you accept the defendant's testimony, his explanation, that the shed was closed when he got there. So, again, he cannot advance a theory on appeal now that really the jury should have rejected his testimony that this woman was involved, rejected his testimony that they used a key to get inside, and the jury should have found him not guilty on some theory that actually when he got there, the doors were wide open, so he didn't have to break and enter, or actually that someone else is the person who went inside at some other time. He can't rise above the fact that that shed was shut and locked when he got to it. And so from that point, the question for the jury is just how did he get past those shut doors and locked doors? Did he do it through a key, or did he do it through a breaking and entering, through kicking down those doors? And we think that based on the testimony the deputy gave, the jury was certainly reasonable in concluding that he got into that shed by breaking down those doors. And there are at least six reasons why I think the jury reasonably rejected that theory that this woman, this woman who was never located, effectuated that entry using a key. The first, of course, is that other than his own statements, there was no evidence that she was ever at the property at the same time as the defendant and Glover. She was not in the photographs that were taken from the game camera. You see the defendant and Mr. Glover. She was not there when the defendant's stepdad helped pull the defendant and the accomplice out of the mud. It was the defendant and the accomplice only. There was no woman around and no woman's son around. Also, you have the fact the defendant, of course, was recently in possession of that stolen property. There's no evidence that this woman was ever in recent possession of that property after it had been removed from the shed. The defendant lied to the investigators when he was confronted with those photographs. He initially told the investigators that it wasn't him in the photographs. He didn't know who those people are. It's at page 94 of the appendix. Clearly, that's evidence that he's trying to hide his guilt. It's clearly proven to be a lie. He eventually admitted at trial that, yeah, he did tell the investigators that. He became agitated when confronted with those pictures, cursed the officer, left without making copies of the receipt that supposedly had a phone number on it. When he got to trial, he claimed that this phone number had been on the receipt all along, but Blanks testified that he never saw a phone number. The investigator testified he never saw a phone number. The defendant clearly lying at trial, which, of course, is affirmative evidence of the defendant's guilt, evidence that he's lying to conceal his involvement of these crimes, and the jury is entitled under Black to infer that is affirmative evidence of his guilt, which, again, places this case outside of the bounds of the Finney case. You also have the age discrepancy between the owner's testimony of how old the real estate agent was, 30 to 40. Mr. Chambers initially said the lady was in her 50s. You have the fact that you have the damage to the doors, which can't be explained absent someone trying to get into that shed. If the entry had been affected solely by a key, there would be no reason to damage the doors.
Mr. Chandoval, there was a period of time that went by where nobody knew what was happening at that shed, correct?
Correct.
I mean, it wasn't a very short period of time.
I think in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth, it was 2 or 3 weeks.
Right. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Chandoval, isn't there evidence that there was a substantial amount of property that was stolen from that shed that was not recovered?
Correct, Your Honor. There was.
Does that lead to the inference that it could have been two burglaries, that someone else broke in the first time, stole some of the property, and left the door open?
I think, Your Honor, that you would still need a couple things. One, I think you would still need some affirmative evidence in the record that a second event occurred, and there's just no affirmative evidence of a second break and entering ever occurring on that property. There's no affirmative evidence in the record that anyone else ever was on that property during this window of time. All the only evidence we have, aside from Chambers' self-serving statements, is that he and his accomplice were there during this period of time. And secondly, the question just becomes, you know, could a reasonable jury have rejected that theory that maybe there were two breakings and two larcenies? And in the absence of any evidence of a second breaking, entering, and larceny, I think the jury could have reasonably rejected that. Plus, you have the fact that that's just not a hypothesis of innocence that was ever advanced at trial. And the only hypotheses that have to be disproven at trial and can be raised on appeal are hypotheses of innocence.
The reason I raise that's kind of the hypothesis of innocence that the Supreme Court came up with in Finney. There was no evidence of a prior burglary, but they said it was up to the Commonwealth to prove that there hadn't been a prior burglary.
Well, and I think in Finney, the reason why there was a greater reason to think that there had been some prior breaking and entering is because in Finney, there was evidence that the number of tools that had been stolen, and I guess the weight and the size of the tools, that two individuals would have had to have been involved in that process. So from that, that's certainly evidence that two people had been at the scene and had been involved in breaking and entering at some prior occasion. And when the defendant in Finney was seen at the scene, he was there by himself. In this case, we don't have that kind of evidence from which to infer that there had been some.
There is some evidence of that because one of the items stolen was a four-wheeler.
Correct, but
wouldn't be something you just load in the back of your pickup truck, at least not very easily.
Right, but the difference in this case, so in Finney, the defendant was there by himself. In this case, even by Mr. Chambers' own admission, he was there with Mr. Glover. So there's every reason to believe that the defendant, Mr. Chambers, and Mr. Glover could have taken all of this property between the two of them while they were there on the property, which they admitted to being there on the property. The difference in Finney was that Mr. Finney was there by himself, and there was no evidence he was there with another individual. And the evidence was such that two people would have had to have been there in order to steal the tools that had been taken from there. And so that evidence supported the conclusion that wasn't sufficiently disproven by the evidence that some prior breaking and entering had occurred. And we just don't have that in this case because we have two individuals instead of just one who were there at the scene. And plus, again, like I said earlier, Mr. Chambers testified. And when a defendant testifies, he can make the Commonwealth case stronger than it otherwise would have been. And that's the Spangler versus Commonwealth case. And that's exactly what happened here, because he limited himself to his claim that he went to that shed, it was shut and locked, and this woman used a key to get inside. That is a theory.
Mr. Chandoval, thank you. I let you go on because you hadn't taken a breath, but your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor. I ask the court to affirm.
Okay. Judge Petty, any questions?
I have no further questions.
Judge Alston?
I want Mr. Chandoval to be able to breathe, so I won't ask anything.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Galanides, you've got about 3.5 minutes.
Oh, thank you, Judge. Your Honors, what has struck me about the Commonwealth argument today is that it is rife with speculation. It is speculative that the jury could have somehow theorized that there was an entry, even though entry was not proven. That there was some sort of breaking, even though a breaking wasn't proven. The Commonwealth has to live and die by its own evidence, and I hate to throw out a case that I didn't cite in my brief, but I'm sure it's a case everyone is familiar with, the Moore versus Commonwealth case, where there was a young child rape victim, and she gave inconsistent statements about penetration. And the court said, look, where the Commonwealth's own evidence is in equipoise, where the Commonwealth's own evidence doesn't clearly support a connect the dots proof of the crime occurring, then we can't just allow the jury to speculate that a crime occurred.
Let me ask you a question, sir.
Yes, sir.
When I hear the term that the evidence is in equipoise, it suggests to me that by its very definition that the evidence that the Commonwealth is offering doesn't make sense or is inconsistent or to the extent that it's not believable. But isn't this case one that sort of comes down to interpretation of the evidence rather than if the evidence is in equipoise?
Well, I think that's why the Commonwealth wants you to adopt Deputy Morgan's interpretation of the evidence, because he testified in his conclusory terms that there had been a break-in or that the door had been quote-unquote kicked in, and I think Judge Petty's analysis of that is actual correct. The door had been kicked and it was dented in, but I don't think that the conclusory testimony of the deputy changes the facts, and the facts are that the Commonwealth did not prove a breaking into this building. If I had to offer an obvious explanation for why there would be damage to the doors, it would be that if a person is accomplishing a theft by using a key, then what better way to throw off the entire investigation than to damage the property and make it appear as though someone had broken in, because that would throw the investigators off the trail of somebody who had a key. I think the presence of a key and the possession of a third party in this case that the Commonwealth chose not to address or refute, even though they were on notice for months that this was the defendant's defense, I think is an utter failure. I don't think it allows the jury to simply reject that theory. I know that there's a delicate balance between that this court engages in on a regular basis between allowing the jury to conclude and resolve the factual issues, but also preserving the due process rights of making sure that there actually was a crime that was committed before the defendant could be convicted of it.
And Mr. Gallanese, I think you ran short. I've got one question for you.
Yes.
Does your argument on your first assignment of error require us, or would require, I guess, a trier of fact, to conclude that it's possible that the door was wide open when they got there? Isn't that the only way that we could say that there was no evidence of a breaking?
No, sir. I would argue that from the defendant's perspective, the court should find that, first, there was no proof of a breaking, that the Commonwealth didn't refute the hypothesis of innocence that Mr. Chambers was allowed in with a key, and
and I know I'm running over here, but bear me, Judge Deck,
yes,
one
sir.
Last question. If the defendant got this real estate agent to open the door by ruse,
yes, sir.
Would that constitute a constructive breaking?
In a hypothetical situation, yes, sir. But I don't believe there's facts in this case that would support that type of conclusion.
All right. Thanks.
Respectfully ask the court to reverse both convictions. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Any other questions from Judge Petty or Judge Alston before we conclude?
No, thanks. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you both, counsel. The case is submitted to the court, and we appreciate your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, for accommodating.
Bye-bye.
Bye.